Welcome to The Indigenous Approach, a podcast where we examine the role of the nation's premier partnership force across the competition continuum, from cooperation to conflict and everything in between. In this episode, the command team from 1st Special Forces Command discuss what brought about the new command vision for 2021 and beyond, the main lines of effort, and focus priorities that drive the nation's premier partnership force.
Greetings. My name is Colonel Ed Crute. I'm the Chief of Staff at 1st Special Forces Command, and I'd like to welcome you to our second episode of our podcast, The Indigenous Approach. This episode is going to focus on a conversation with our command team about our recently released vision statement for the command. I'd like to begin by introducing our command team. Sir?
Major General John Brennan, 1st Special Forces Command Commander.
Command Sergeant Major Ted Munner, CSM, 1st Special Forces Command.
Brigadier General Steve Marks, I'm the Deputy Commanding General at 1st Special Forces Command.
And I'm CW5 David Holton. I'm the Command Chief Warrant Officer for 1st Special Forces Command.
All right, thanks, gentlemen. The background for this vision statement starts with the USASOC strategy, where the Commanding General, General Baudet, directed in his strategy that the force needed a mindset change from FOB-centric operations to one of competition and conflict with near-peer threats and enemies. That started a conversation and then a deeper look at the culture and identity of the Special Forces Regiment specifically, with a conclusion that there was, to some degree, an identity crisis within the force. And really was the point of departure then for the commanding general to turn and say, what do you do about a confusion of purpose within the force to some degree? Let's publish a vision. So from that point, the staff got together and created a draft. After reviewing the first draft, the vision was then passed out to all of our command teams for a look. And we also shared that widely with other special forces, civil affairs, and PSYOP soldiers, NCOs, warrant officers, and officers across the force, about 250 in total, and asked them for a look at what we were trying to accomplish with the vision. Received a lot of great feedback, worked that into the final draft, which was just approved and released out to the force. So today, we'd like to hear from the command team what exactly this vision's purpose was and what it means to the force. And so with that, what drove the vision? Why now? And what do you mean by first to observe, first to influence, and first to compete?
Sure, Ed. Thanks for asking that question. Really, it's a matter of necessity. Plus, we were directed to pivot toward our near-peer competitors by the Secretary of Defense first in 2018 while we were simultaneously fighting the CT fight. That's obviously a lot of turmoil. We've redeployed a lot of our formations, but we have the opportunity to compete more globally with our NDS threats. And we are actually seeing a confluence between the CT fight and the NDS threats, because we're finding in places like Afghanistan and Syria, countries like Russia and Iran are funding some of the VEO organizations that are attacking our forces and our partners. We have transformed the way we are fighting and how we are fighting because our footprint has changed. We have to do more with less. As well as the fact our competitors have leveraged 19 years of us fighting VEOs to modernize their own formations, and we're playing catch up. We modernized as the DOD throughout the CT fight to some extent, but it was in support of CT, very specific niche capabilities that may or may not be as pertinent to fighting a near-peer competitor like Russia or China. We're going to continue the VEO fight, but we're also modernizing and innovating in a way that allows us to better compete with those near-peer competitors at the same time and provide the conventional force some time and space to modernize their major weapon systems and their capabilities as well. To your point, to the first to observe, first to influence, and first to compete, we've always been doing that. We've maintained a global footprint despite the counter-VEO fight for the last 20 years. We've not stopped doing things in countries where there aren't terrorists. Our partners remain on our side, and we continue to make our partners better across the globe. Our global footprint allows us to be the first to observe any encroachment by near-peer competitors into our battle space. And then our proximity to our partners and the capabilities that we have helped them develop allow us to compete with those near-peer competitors across the globe as well.
I just want to jump in real quick on the vision statement, or really the vision and what's its real purpose. I think that, you know, for the vision, you got to understand it succinctly describes the goals of your organization. So the vision is looking out at the future. What does tomorrow hold? And then what the mission statement does is looks at today and then how do we get after achieve those goals. It's important. One of the things that I talk about, and a real quick story for all you guys, is, you know, with my two sons, I've got a 17-year-old and I've got an 11-year-old, and I talk about goals and being you know, mindful of the fact that you've got to set goals in your life and you've got to have kind of a pathway and where you want to achieve what you want to achieve in your life. And even at the young age of 11, 17, I talked to them about this because I want them to understand that without goals, without a vision, without an end state, then you're basically muddling through life and you're never going to be able to reach those goals that you've established or maybe you hadn't even thought about. So with my 11-year-old, what I do is I take him into the back bedroom of our house. We have a closet that I put a blindfold on my son and I spin him around and I said, I want you to walk out to the back door of the house through the garage and then turn on the back light. That's your mission. That's your goal. So he does. He laughs about it. He starts to walk around and hits maybe hits the ottoman, maybe hits the wall, maybe hit the island in the kitchen, maybe fall down, maybe take a couple of lumps and some bruises, but ultimately he gets to that light and he turns it on. Do the same thing with my 17-year-old son. And I say, I'm just going to put the blindfold on you and spin you around. Now I want you to start walking. He says, where am I walking to, Dad? And I said, I'll let you know when you get there. So he does the same thing. He hits the ottoman. He hits the island in the kitchen. He may hit the door going out to the garage. And then finally he gets frustrated and he falls down enough to the point where he just looks at me and says, this is stupid. I don't know where I'm going. And I said, that's the point. You need to know where you're going. And I think that this codifies it for the command. It codifies it for the entire 23,000 that are in our formation.
If you can't describe who you are and what you're for, because we had a lot of different visions based off a lot of your research that showed that we had different optics on that, and I think this brings it all together. So our ability to be the partner of choice across the globe, to really recognize that our value is the indigenous approach to problem solving globally is what makes us special.
Yeah, and to feed off what the CG just said, what draws me to this document is the value. Every professional in a workforce wants to be value added to that job, if you will. And every organization wants to provide some type of value to its higher headquarters. So when I look at what does First Special Forces Command, what kind of value does it provide? I look at direct support for strategic objectives. Well, I would caveat that and kind of throw it out and say, hey, look, as practitioners of irregular warfare, you know, our forces, our cross-functional teams are uniquely trained, educated, and postured to fight in the human dimension of war in the most austere and complex environments. And then secondly, what I would tell you is our command responds to global crises. And we also have an established directive from SOCOM to establish the Special Operations Joint Task Force contingency, which would form the Army Corps of that SOF headquarters to provide one single SOF voice for a joint force.
To your point, sir, and your vignette about your sons, often the military is accused of fighting and preparing for the last war. And what I hear you saying is this vision is looking at what we think the next war is going to be. If we're out as the first to observe and warn others, how is that valuable to partners?
I would also say that we enable our gym partners, our joint interagency, intergovernmental, and multinational partners. And that could be anything from overflight rights, information sharing, or access and placement to certain areas that we may not have, but one of those organizations could have too.
Excellent.
It's one, it's highlighting and illuminating for a lot of our partners, both here in the Beltway or back in the States, those gene partners, but also it's building those relationships. That is one of the lines of effort for this command, is those relationships. They're critical, and highlighting this in a community of interest brings attention to a problem that may not have been identified in the past. It may be that they don't know anything about. And that's where I see with our forward presence in potentially 70 to 80 different nations at any given time, we bring that relevance to our strategic leaders.
I think it's bringing coherency to the mosh pit, if you will. If everybody's got a capability and they're all in the same space doing their own thing, you got chaos, right? But if we can point out potential vulnerabilities, point out potential opportunities to our partners, let them execute to provide purpose to the fight, I think that's hugely important. And that's part of what our value proposition is.
Excellent. And you mentioned in there as well, I mean, we see ourselves in a supporting role in many cases, to our gym partners, and in many cases, the glue of the team to come together that can partner to solve the nation's toughest problems.
And it's amazing what you can accomplish when you don't care who gets the credit, right? Yeah,
absolutely, sir.
As long as you get the effect.
Okay. With that, that's being the value that we provide. Sergeant Major, could you say a word about the 1st Special Forces Command's mission statement?
Our mission is to assign, equip, train, and validate RSOF for theater and national objectives. Now, this document really provides the strategic framework in how 1st Special Forces Command is going to get after and actually assign, equip, train, certify, and validate RSOF soldiers for deployment. While many in the audience will say that sounds like a typical Title 10 headquarters function, I'd like to take a few minutes to quickly discuss the certify and the validate aspect of RSOF soldiers and cross-functional teams, because that's new. As far as I know, we are the only Title 10 headquarters that has the responsibility to certify and validate RSOF soldiers and units for deployment. And that has been something that has come up over the last 2 years and is now a requirement for this headquarters. I think we'll get into a little bit more of the bold shift in how we assign and train and equip, but I think it is important to highlight that we now have that responsibility to validate and to certify our subordinate RSOF formations.
And with that new addition to our mission statement, sir, why is validation important?
So that the TSOCs can understand what product they're getting, and they can take comfort in the fact that they have been validated to the task to which they've been assigned. So heretofore, it wasn't always that case. We were burning the candle at both ends, if you will, when we had, 9 or 10 SOTFs out there at the same time. We didn't have time to take a step back, look at the tasks that element was being asked to accomplish, and then presenting a validation plan that was agreed upon by everybody, and then having that unit execute it. We can do that now. We have a little more headspace and timing that we can play with, and we have a lot more ability to have that command oversight, because heretofore, a couple years ago, this headquarters was in the fight in Sojitifo IR. There wasn't a whole lot left behind to do the validation piece, and now we have that codified.
I've been in special operations roughly 23 years, 21 of those years operationally, and you always hear validation exercise prior to deployment. It's certified. Well, validated and certified to do what? And who was the actual certification and validation authority? And what did they use to validate and certify you for deployment? It never happened.
So I think also with the mission statement, and Chief alluded to it, which is that on-order mission, the Special Operations Joint Task Force contingency, that's where we form the core of that Sojitif headquarters. And we have that mission command authority and our requirement to provide mission command of our SOF forces. And we also create the synergy across the domains to converge combat power, including those RSOF cross-functional teams. I really like, though, the way that General Brennan talks about the Sojitif C. When we look at the convergence of all domains, we see that as we go through the continuum of conflict, through that spectrum, through competition, as we manage that up to conflict, that's where we see the value of the Sojitif C. I don't know, sir, if you want to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Army, we're focused rightly so on large-scale combat operations. In my mind, if we get to a large-scale combat operation, then we've failed, because one of our key value propositions, as Chief said, is using that global soft network to prevent a crisis from happening and or dissuading a competitor from potentially creating a crisis because we've changed their decision calculus. That's one of the values added with our formations, so that we don't have to deploy the Sojitif C. But if we do, we can converge all those multi-domain capabilities at the right point in space and time to have the optimal effects against our adversaries.
In order to drive a 24,000-person organization, you've used 4 lines of effort to try and frame and prioritize for the organization what's important in the direction that you want them to go. The Army and USASOC have laid their lines of effort out as people, readiness, and modernization. Here at 1st Special Forces Command, you've adopted people and readiness, but you changed the word from modernization to innovation, and you added relationships so that we have 4 lines of effort in our command. Under people, Sergeant Major, what are we trying to do?
So I'll start first with talent management. It's something that, as an organization, I don't think that we've done a really good job in the past.
We always talk about talent management, but rarely do we ever look at an individual and align that individual into a job that best fits his talent. At best, we've done purposeful management of some individuals, but rarely do we do talent management. And so we've got to do a better job at looking out across the formation and identifying individuals with a very specific talent and aligning those individuals into positions that best maximizes use of that talent. That also goes into the career pathways to some degree, both on officer and the NCO side. On the NCOs, we are beholden to a professional development timeline that is outdated, quite frankly, in my opinion, archaic, that holds you to career gates and timelines that you must meet in order to get promoted to the next rank. For the officers, it's even worse. Everything is geared around the command track, and about 5% of those top-tier officers that are in line for a battalion or group or higher command. And then everything is about those 5% and aligning those individuals into the right jobs to keep them competitive for those command tracks. And when we have NCOs and we have officers that are great at what they do, we penalize them for being on an ODA too long or being operational or having a niche capability that the Army doesn't recognize in its PD model or in its command track. What is it that we do for those individuals that stay in the 4th Battalion, the Jedburghs, the RSCs, that we need 3 to 5 plus years of time to build the true experience that this nation needs without penalizing their career? What do we do for our multi-purpose canine handlers? What do we do with those individuals that find their way into the cyber realm and are great coders? Because the model says they're not going to get promoted. Same with the officers. How do we keep an officer on an ODA for 3 years? How do we keep him in a niche capability that doesn't impact his chances at promotion? The NCOs, they may never be a team sergeant. Some of them may not want to be. That's okay. Does that mean they shouldn't be an E8? The Army system says that's not the case. You're a terminal E7. Same for some of the officers, is if you don't meet those gates, you're not going to be promoted to lieutenant colonel or colonel. And therefore, we bleed talent left and right on both the officer side and the NCO side. We've got to do a better job in building out a professional development model for both the officers and the NCOs that allows us to retain this talent, that allows us to maximize the talent of those individuals, even if they're niche capabilities, into places where we can maximize and not penalize them. If we continue to do it, we're going to continue to bleed talent. They're either going to leave the Army for something better, they're going to go to another organization, or in case of the officers, they're going to go to functional areas. So I think that our entire professional development model on both sides needs to be scrapped. And we need to start over and develop one that is not common at all, because SOF in particular has a wide array of talents in its formation.
So just to pile on a little bit what the CSM was talking about with talent management, I think it's critical to have the conversation with your people to figure out what their talents are, what their passions are, because, and that requires everyone, every leader, to sit down and have that conversation, to discuss what is it that you want to do in your career? Because what you may find out is they don't want to be on that path. Command, battalion command, or being a battalion CSM may not be something that they want to aspire to. Maybe it's something else that they're passionate. Maybe they've got a skill set or a proclivity for something dealing in the cyber or with electronic warfare. And so having the conversations with your teammates and just saying, okay, well, what do you want to do? And then help assist them to get them on the correct pathway. Help put them on those treadmills that we've talked about so that they can achieve their goals and what they aspire to leave as a legacy in their organization, and then also maintain the talent-rich
What I hear General Mark saying is it starts with engaged leadership. And what I'm hearing the Sergeant Major say also is we have to get out of the industrial age and into the information age, if you will. And that can go in the readiness bin as well. It starts with engaged leadership, daily leader-centric training, You have to have all the right equipment. And when we talk about equipment, we need to procure critical equipment, whether that's a P2 or a P11 solution, and then get after the next generation of technological advances to make our fighting force the best equipped that we can. And then lastly, what I will also say is it ties back into our small nodes or small footprints or sensors. We have to be able to project that capability at any given time. But it all comes down to, in my opinion, for readiness, it's engaged leadership.
It is. We have to get out of the mindset of round peg, round hole, insert. I have a SWIC requirement to send so many, therefore I'm just putting bodies to the task and I'm not identifying those individuals that have the knack of teaching. Every SF guy is not a great instructor across the board. You have to talk to your subordinates. You have to understand what it is that they want to do. And do we have the capability of training them and getting them to do what they want to do in the Army so that it benefits the organization and we don't lose them? If that's the case, then let's pursue it. Don't let somebody tell you no, that you have an 18 Bravo who wants to be a cyber guy. Let's push him down to the cyber school. Let's put him through the cyber training, and then let's bring him back as an SF qualified 17 Echo. That only benefits him. And more importantly, it benefits the organization.
And the chief staff of the Army said, we're in a war for talent. He's right. Without that talent, we're not going to win. So investing in our people, breaking the old molds, getting out of the industrial age processes and the way we've manned our formations really since World War II ain't going to cut it in the future. So we've already put Green Berets in space. We should be able to put PSYOPers in space. And then those folks should be able to come back and forth between soft formations and new formations that are out there. We haven't even talked about the Space Force yet. I'm sure there should be a soft component of that as well.
You hit it at the end there, sir. The Army, with its talent management task force, is asking the branches to be bold. Think boldly. What does change look like? So with that, we'll use that as the segue into the third line of effort, sir. You deliberately chose the word innovation over modernization.
On the heels of our innovation symposium that we had, we learned that we should be innovating more and then how to innovate more efficiently and effectively. And it's everything. It's not just the latest tech, which is important, but making sure our processes, the way we do business, our business rules are also innovative as well. There's a lot more we could be doing across the information environment right now if we had the right process in place. I think that is equally important as the tech piece going forward. But we're looking for disruptive technology, not just the next best thing. Instead of the next best MVG tube, why not have a face shield that transitions between daylight and night conditions so you don't have to carry around a bunch of heavy tubes? Why do we have Peltors that have been around for 20 years when we should have earbuds and things that are wireless that we put inside of our ear that weigh about a fraction of the weight? You know, the next best truck may not have wheels. I don't know. But we got to explore those venues and we got to fail early and often, get our hands on as much equipment as we can, you know, on the front end, and then work to make it better and make it applicable to the things we need it to. But if we don't get that opportunity, you know, we're not going to compete with Russia and China. And really the innovation paradigm has shifted. It's flipped upside down. World War II, DOD was the innovator of choice. We created all kinds of things out of necessity, microwave, radar, you pick it. Without that impetus, it probably wouldn't have happened. Well, now the civilian sector is really running the market on innovation with technology. And we have to be tied into it to keep up. You know, heretofore, we talk about the whole of government approach. For true innovation, it's going to be a whole of nation approach, I think. To get after that, or we're not gonna compete.
But that ties lastly into the last line of effort, which is the relationships. And again, that boils down to that is everything, and it's interwoven in everything that we do in First Special Forces Command. Our PSYOPs and our civil affairs soldiers and our Green Berets are the most connected soldiers, our soft soldiers out there on the battlefield and in both permissive and semi-permissive environments. They have those relationships. And those relationships don't just resonate when they're OCONUS, but those relationships exist here, CONUS, with the GEM partners. Those relationships with interagency is phenomenal, and those matter. And I think one of the things that General Brennan, at the beginning when we started laying out these lines of effort, he said, these are critical
But relationships matter the most. So we need to have those relationships. And I see it with all the CSUs. They have done a phenomenal job in building those relationships. The relationships that they have built throughout the last 20 years in places like Iraq or Syria or in Afghanistan, they continue to be fruitful. In my case, being called back over for the peace negotiations and the peace discussions with the Taliban, because I've had relationships with some of the Afghan leaders, is just one example. But we've got numerous examples in our formations.
And it's not just about our gym relationships. It's also about the relationships that we have with academia. It's about the relationships that we have with industry. We have E7s, E8s, and O3s out there integrated with and building relationships where the Army wants O5s and O6s having those relationships and those conversations.
I think powering down the authorities, as our footprint shrink, we're going to be asking captains and master sergeants to do things that, as you said, lieutenant colonels have been doing for a while. As our footprint shrinks, we got to power down authorities, let folks do what they can do. And then the relationship piece, that goes to academia as well. We can't innovate if we don't have the education system set up to create innovators. So if they can't go to school in places like University of Maryland, Duke, then they're not going to get the education that they need to become true innovators, especially on the tech side.
Yeah, and I think the conversation we're having right now pretty much highlights, in my opinion, why we are the nation's premier partnership force. Because I would contest that every RSOF soldier, relationships are within their DNA.
That and every one of those partnerships with academia and industry ties directly back to the warfighter on the ground. There's not layers of bureaucracy.
It's clear in every word that you say that relationships and partnerships and building teams is a critical part of what we do. To better understand your priority objectives, describe the Information Warfare Center, Special Operations Joint Task Force contingency, the hard target defeat companies, the cross-functional teams, and the Army Special Operations Forces Training Center.
Sure. First of all, the Information Warfare Center, very nascent capability that we're standing up really to compete in the information environment. That's what it's all about. And then growing that thing from what is starting out as a PSYOPs-based organization into a full information warfare task force that has all the resident information-related capabilities in it, from SEMA to space to PSYOPs, MILDEC. But that's the goal. That's where we need to get to be able to compete in the information environment with near-peer competitors. It stood up. It's part of the 8th Psychological Operations Group. It's part of the 3rd Psychological Operations Battalion, and it was heretofore called the RAC. So what we've got is information warfare detachments that are part of the IWC. Each of those detachments is going to work on a specific national defense strategy threat. That's the goal. Without the ability to deploy folks because of COVID, we saw the need to be able to message and then conduct psychological operations from the CONUS base. That's what the IWC allows us to do. Support our nodes forward, because as we stand up information warfare task forces on the edge, the need to help backstop them and provide them CONUS-based support is hugely important. You know, the goal is to expand it to support gym partners to compete against Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and VEOs.
Chief, would you mind describing the SJTF-C?
Sure. The Special Operations Joint Task Force contingency serves here as a convergence headquarters. It's capable of providing at echelon above brigade campaign, expeditionary campaigning, whether that's in time of crises or conflict. Then it could also be augmented to Theater Special Operations Command in steady state operations, whether that's through exercise planning or contingency planning of some of the con plans that are out there. Then obviously the SJTF-C will form the core, the Army core, of the task force, which will enable the joint force commander to have that one soft mission command voice for the RSOF contributions that it makes to the joint fight.
So I've got cross-functional teams. And so one of the things that we've looked at and what we've learned is that we are much more effective when we combine all of our capabilities, that being the psychological operations, civil affairs, and Green Berets or Special Forces. And so cross-functional teams is a combination of those unique capabilities being deployed for purpose in the locations where they are able to compete with our adversaries. And then with hard target defeat companies, it's really, we've learned we need to have a capability that goes after these hard targets, those places that are just too difficult, underground facilities, subterranean missions, where we're able to deploy a capability, a company that has mastered those skill sets. And that's the important part of the hard target companies is that they are built to defeat hard targets in sensitive and constricted environments.
And there's a huge counter WMD portfolio that goes along with that. So our partners are seeing the need in a combined manner to defeat some of these hard targets that have potential WMD in it, as well as how does SOCOM expand the labor pool for counter WMD without bringing in partners? We have to do it. So the hard target defeat companies also provide that mechanism to bring our partners' capabilities to bear in support of operations against the near peers.
Sergeant Major, in order to train and exercise for this this new environment, what does the RSOF TC mean to the command team?
If this vision articulates that we, as First Special Forces Command, play a lead role for the nation in competition, where do we train and exercise for competition? Where do we train cyberspace and space for disruption activities that is not only virtual, but ties back to a physical training realm? Right now, there's nowhere. We have JRTC and NTC, but they train for conflict. They don't train for competition. With the RSOF Training Center, with the amount of area that is out there, the fact that we own all of the land from ground base to space provides tremendous opportunities for us to create complex multi-domain peer and near-peer training environments that are both scalable and tailorable to really challenge our RSOF cross-functional teams. Additionally, as the CG said earlier, innovation and modernization is about getting our hands on equipment, testing that equipment, and making it better. The RSOF Training Center provides a perfect venue to test and evaluate and make that equipment better and put it back into industry and academia and tell them what it does good, what it does bad, and what we need it to do in the future.
Absolutely. So I think the RSOF TC, you know, heretofore it's been the PMT site is what it was called many years ago. We put some vehicles out there. We used it, I wouldn't say haphazardly, but not as much as we could. So we're making a deliberate investment, as the CSM said, putting a deliberate mechanism out there to do the multi-domain operations in a training environment, a synthetic environment, as well as bring those near-peer adversary capabilities to bear on us so that we know how to react when the time comes and we have to execute operations in a comms-denied environment or a A2AD, air defense-denied area. We can do it. Because we've trained to the hard standard.
Excellent, sir. And so what I hear you saying is the place to go and test, fail, if necessary, to learn, and a place where maybe the end state is to keep it short of conflict and not necessarily go into conflict every
right.
time.
And if it does go to conflict, we can inflict the maximum pain on our adversary. I mean, success looks like your sovereign partner is in charge of their own security. So once we achieve that and we come home, we have to have a place where we can test and evaluate our own equipment and our TTPs for the future.
That's that. With that, sir, there's one other point that I'd like to make that I've heard you say many times in the direction that you've given us. And it harkens a little bit to Chief's point about the information age. And what's certain about the information age is change. And so a lot of times when you put a vision out as a military organization, you tend to think that vision is going to last 3 or 4 years. But you've been telling us all along that, you know, the vision is as good as our understanding of the change in the environment. And so, you know, we're going to be ready to evolve as the Army learns more about MDO and as SOCOM learns more about its role in the competition and the conflict environment. And we stand ready to continue to drive this vision as that centering point for us and the purpose for the organization. Next step is to come together as the team and build out what it takes to realize that vision. Thank you for your time and look forward to talking with you again in our next episode.
This has been The Indigenous Approach. We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Follow us on social media. If you have suggestions for topics or guests, send us a message. Thank you for listening.